We're going to continue this morning in our exploration of the life of David. Last week we talked about perhaps the most familiar, the most famous stories about David and Goliath, where David, the 15-year-old shepherd boy, slays the giant, kills Goliath because of his faithfulness, because of the power of God. He kills Goliath. This week we're going to talk about a story that is perhaps a little bit less familiar. But the story is kind of anchored in a statement. It's a definitive statement about this story that I think was true to this story, and I think it's true in our lives. And the definitive statement is this: the ways of God are most unappealing and seemingly irrelevant when we are angry, isolated, or afraid. That means if you are angry, isolated, or afraid, that will undermine the resolve of even the most devout person. If you are the world's best Christian and you even have the t-shirt that says so, when you are angry, isolated, and perhaps afraid, it will kind of change your ethical and moral boundaries. It will push you beyond the guardrails that you've set up in your life. Last week we talked about David becoming a giant killer because he killed the giant. And this week we have to understand that there were also killer giants that perhaps David was unable to slay, at least at first. And if you open your bulletin today, you actually have a picture of three giants, at least what I think a big scary giant looks like. You have an opportunity to name these, because I believe the killer giants, if we were to give them a name today for our discussion, the killer giants are in fact anger, isolation, and fear. These are the giants that will mold and oftentimes shift your ethical and moral boundaries. In fact, if you look back to your biggest regret in life, whatever that happens to be, it was probably something you did that was motivated by being angry, isolated, or afraid. When we experience these emotions and we come up against these giants, sometimes we just feel like we need to do something. Sometimes we just feel like we need to do anything, literally anything. But oftentimes the things that we choose to do, and we'll see in this story, just make us angrier. They make us lonelier, and oftentimes they even make us scareder. When we think of David's most significant blunder in life, when you think about Scripture and the big screw-ups in David's life, what's the name that comes to mind? Bathsheba, right. When we think of David's most significant blunders, it's normally about a girl. And her name was Bathsheba. But this blunder actually occurs a little bit sooner, and it's about a sword. See, the story of David and Bathsheba occurs when David was king, and he was in his 50s. And he's very famous for that story. This story is a little bit less famous. It actually occurs when David is in his 20s, just a few years after he slayed Goliath. Now, understand, when David killed Goliath, he became an instant superstar. He became an instant rock star, and people sang songs about him. And he gained instant popularity and a lot of influence because this was the shepherd boy that killed the giant. But as oftentimes is the case, do you know what happens when a young boy gets a lot of fame and success a little bit too soon? Actually, this is what happens when we get a little fame and success at a young age. For those of you unfamiliar, the doughy-eyed, talented Justin Bieber had a little bit of talent and got a ton of notoriety at a young age and turned into that weirdo there on the right. He got a lot popular a lot quick, and that can skew even the best perspective, and now he sometimes does silly things. And many of you young people are copying his haircuts. We'll talk about that later. But David had instant popularity because he killed the giant. And Saul, who was king at the time, became very, very insecure. Very, very paranoid, because here was this kid who had done this thing that was becoming obviously even more popular than the king. So Saul kind of ascribed to the philosophy of keep your friends close, keep your enemies closer. And so he plotted a little bit. He tried to get David to marry one of his daughters. He tried to set him up, and David wouldn't do that because he didn't feel worthy at that point to be the king's son-in-law. Ultimately, David would become best friends with the king's son, Jonathan. We read that in Scripture. And then ultimately, David would marry one of the king's other daughters. So now David is, in fact, Saul's son-in-law. And he was gaining a lot of power and he was gaining a lot of influence. And Saul didn't want to kill him because that would have just probably helped his notoriety. So he sends him on suicide missions that were impossible, and David comes back victorious. And so their entire relationship revolves around this contention of being in and out of the king's favor. And it all comes to a head at dinner, as it usually does. They're gathered around the family table, and that dinner with the king was a significant event. You've got servants, you've got the entire family, you've got the feast before you. And at this point, David was skipping dinner a lot. Because of the relationship that he had with Saul, he wasn't showing up to dinner, but we can assume that Saul and his wife or wives were there, and Jonathan was there, and the king's daughters, David's wife, would have been there. And David's not showing up for dinner, and Jonathan oftentimes made excuses for David as to why he wasn't there, and sometimes David's wife, the king's daughter, would make excuses. And it finally comes to a head at dinner, and I can't think of a better way to begin our scripture reading this morning with 1 Samuel chapter 20, verse 30, which says, "Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan," that's his son, "and he looked at him and said, 'You son of a perverse, rebellious woman.'" Anybody ever have that happen at your dinner table? We've altered that phrase a little bit in our English language to a point we can't use it in church anymore, but Saul looked at his son said, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman." And this was family dinner. In all likelihood, the perverse and rebellious woman was sitting across the table. And he goes on, he says, "Do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse," that was David, "to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness?" That phrase there just means to the mother who bore you. You know, he gave Jonathan the spiel that a lot of parents give their kids. "After all I've done for you, and your mother who laid down and bore you how many hours in labor, how dare you?" The woman who he had just, of course, referred to as a perverse and rebellious woman. There were always issues in families and with wives because they had too many wives. That was generally the problem. And anytime you're in a culture that has favorite wives, that's always a bad thing. So he's holding his son to task and he's calling out John and says, "You've picked David over me. You've picked David over your mother. How could you?" And then he gets to the crux of the matter. In verse 31, he says, "For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die." So Saul gets to the heart of the matter. He's kind of telling Jonathan, "Look, you're the heir to the throne. You're the king's son. And as long as this kid is running around with all this popularity and all this notoriety, you know that's not going to happen." So Saul is really trying to preserve his legacy. And he finally says, "Look, we're going to have to send for David and he's going to have to be killed." Saul felt so threatened and was so paranoid of this giant killer. But Jonathan cared for David very much, and he actually went to David and said, "Look, dude, you got to leave town. Dad's crazy. And in fact, you probably don't just want to leave town. You probably want to leave the country because he's going to come after you. And if the king comes after you, eventually he'll find you and eventually you'll be killed." So the giant killer now faces some killer giants. David faces what we spoke of earlier. He becomes angry. He becomes isolated. He becomes afraid. He has to flee the king. He has to run for his life. He has to be by himself. And he does what a lot of us do if we are angry, if we are isolated, or if we are afraid. He panicked. He lost sight of the fact that God was with him. And anyone could look at his situation just like we can look at anyone else's situation, but it's harder to look at our own and say, "Why in the world would you do that?" We can look at this story. After we get to the end of this story, you'll be able to look at David's situation and go, why would you do that? And you can look at situations of family members and friends and coworkers and you say, "Why did you do that?" Well, it was because they were angry, isolated, or afraid. Why did you buy that? Why did you go there? Why did you marry that? Why did you date that? Because I was angry, isolated, or afraid. So the story continues. 1 Samuel chapter 21 says, "Then David, who was fleeing, came to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest." Now, the way things worked back then, Jerusalem was not part of the capital. They didn't have a temple to speak of. So the temple or the tabernacle at this point was simply a mobile situation, and they would move the tabernacle to wherever they considered to be the most safe at the time. And that was where, that was kind of where everything revolved around. That was the epicenter of their worship, was at the tabernacle. And the place that the tabernacle was at this point was a place called Nob. And Ahimelech was the chief priest, so he was there at the tabernacle. It says, David fled to Nob to Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech came to meet David, trembling, and said to him, "Why are you alone and no one with you?" Now here's the thing you have to understand about David. David was a mighty warrior, and perhaps some of you have heard of David's mighty men. David traveled with 1,000 warriors. He never went anywhere alone. So for David to show up at the tabernacle by himself, kind of the priest immediately knows there's something wrong. And he's like, "What are you doing here? Why are you by yourself?" We can assume David probably looked like he hadn't slept in a couple days. He might have looked a little disheveled because he was fleeing the king. And Ahimelech says, "Why are you here and why are you by yourself?" And David said to Ahimelech the priest, and here's the problem. David lied. David lies. And David was a good Jewish, good Hebrew boy, and lying cracks the top 10. We know that. We know that, but he would also know that because he was in the tabernacle. And he was probably no more than 10, 20 feet away from the Ark of the Covenant, which contained the top 10, like the original copy. And David looks at this priest, and he lies. We're going to see what he lies about, but he lied because he was afraid. Because he was isolated, and because he was afraid and angry. David said to Ahimelech the priest, "The king has charged me with a matter and said to me, 'Let no one know anything of the matter about which I send you, and with which I have charged you. I have made an appointment with the young men for such and such a place.'" It's not even a good lie. It's so lame. This is a child caught in trouble kind of lie. "Why are you alone, David?" "Because the king sent me on a secret mission." Yeah, it's so secret that nobody knows about it. That's how secret it is, because it's a secret. And I'm supposed to meet a guy, a secret guy, at a secret place at such and such of a secret time. So David just lies to the priest to cover why he is there by himself. And as we will see in this story, if we think about, you can think about the consequences of every action, this was simply a lie, one little lie, that would ultimately cost an entire family their life. Verse 3. "Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever is here." Now this becomes a little bit more weird, because now not only has David showed up by himself, the mighty man of warrior without his mighty men, he's hungry. The king's son-in-law is hungry. So now he is on this secret mission and he has no food. And the priest replies in verse 4, priest answered David, "I have no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread." Now, how this worked is the priests would make fresh bread every day, and they would lay it on the temple, on the altar, as a sacrifice, as an act of worship, and they would leave the bread there overnight. Now, in the morning, they would come back, and God hadn't eaten the bread, so they would keep the bread, and that's what the priests eat, but it was considered consecrated. Only the priests could eat it, or you had to be ceremonially clean to eat it. And the priest says, "Well, we don't have like snacks. We don't have food here, but I've got some consecrated bread." And David was, as a married man, probably was not ceremonially clean to eat this consecrated bread. That's all you need to know about that. But verse 6 says, "So the priest gave him the holy bread, and David eats the consecrated bread." Now this was significant. We kind of gloss over that, but because we're Christians and we eat all the bread, but. In Jewish culture, eating that consecrated bread was such a step in a negative direction. So David shows up, and he's disheveled, and he's scared, and he's angry, and he lies to the priest, tells him he's on a secret mission, and now he's eating the consecrated bread. And we have to ask at some point, what happened to the guy? Remember the psalm last week? "Oh God, in you I put my trust. I wait on you all the day long." What happened to that guy? Now he's sneaking around, lying to priests, eating consecrated bread. And then the moment turns, and it's such a dramatic moment in verse 8. David said to Ahimelech, "Then have you not here a spear or sword at hand? For I have brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste. You are the most famous warrior in the country, and you don't even got a blade on you. Your secret, super secret mission with the super secret people at the super secret place was so super secret and had to be pulled off in such a hurry you didn't bring any weapons. So David is hitting up the priest for a weapon. Do you have anything here? Now, the one place you would not have found weapons was generally the tabernacle or the temple. Everybody would have had a weapon except the priests. So David has no food. He's looking for a weapon. And then there is a wake-up call moment. This should be the moment in the story where David kind of realizes what's going on, kind of clears his head, and turns and goes a different way. If this was a movie and everything was being built to this moment, this would be the climax, because something is about to happen and information is about to be revealed that is just like the aha moment. If it was a movie, there would be a dramatic sound such as this. David asks for a weapon, and the priest responds like this. The priest said, "The sword of Goliath, the Philistine, whom you struck down in the valley of Elah, behold, it is here. The symbol of your greatest victory is here, David. The symbol of when you became the David that we all know and love you to be is here." Now, the way we understand this, we know from the story that after David killed Goliath, he kind of paraded around with that sword for a while because it was cool. But at some point, he gave it to the temple or gave it to the tabernacle as an act of worship or to be consecrated, just to be part of their really cool stuff, the spoils of war, so to speak. And it's there in the tabernacle. The tabernacle didn't have weapons, but they happen to have this sword of Goliath. He's like, this is the only weapon we have. And that sword had to be packed with so many memories of just a few years ago. That was the sword of a guy that said, in the face of a giant, as a 15-year-old boy, "I will kill you. I will kill you because God is with me. I will strike you down." And if you remember the passage from last week, from 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 47, and he says, all the assembly gathered here will know that God is God because I'm going to kill you. That was the sword that represented that. And what happened to that guy? What happened to the boy that ran toward danger? The boy who would ultimately write our most familiar psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd, I will fear no evil." Well, what happened to him was anger, loneliness, and fear. The giants that will undermine even the strongest faith. That verse continues. Ahimelech is speaking. He says, "It's wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you will take that, take it, for there is none but that here." We don't have weapons here, but we've got this. And he brings out the sword. And at this point, the priest has to be thinking, none of this makes sense. David, his mighty men, he's traveling without his mighty men. He doesn't have any food. He doesn't have any weapons. And he brings this sword out. He's like, well, I mean, it's David. It's his sword anyway. And this decision would become a permanent part of David's story. David finishes up that verse and says, "There is none like that. Give it to me." So David lies and he runs away with that sword. And when Ahimelech brought out the sword, that should have been the aha moment. Like, what in the world am I doing? This sword represents a victory. This sword represents what I used to be, what I should be aspiring to be. This sword represents everything God has done for me. This sword represents the launching point that God put a rocket on my back and shot me straight to the moon. But instead he takes the sword and he flees. Because what happens is, David, in that situation, when we find ourselves in situations, when we are angry, isolated, or afraid, when we need God the most, we think, if God were with me, this wouldn't be happening. We opt for things that never worked before, but somehow they're supposed to work now, and we end up with a flawed response, utilizing flawed weapons. And as we'll see in this story, we end up with a disastrous response. And we see it in others, but it's so hard to see in ourselves. But the reality is, it's easy to trust God when you don't have much to trust him with or much to trust him for. but to surrender our life and the baggage and the problems and the fear and the isolation and the anger. That's something completely different. The story continues. David would flee, and this is you again, we can see it in others. We can look at David and be like, why would you do that? He flees and he goes to Philistine country. Now, for those of you who remember the story from last week, Goliath was a Philistine, and the Israelites were constantly fighting the Philistines, and David flees to Philistine country. Not only does he go to Philistine country, David flees to an area called Gath. If you remember from the story last week, Goliath was from Gath. So David, with Goliath's sword, the giant that he killed a few years back, goes to Gath, because that was smart. And he actually tries to enlist in the Philistine army. And they're like, you're David. We don't want you, you can't be in our army. And so then David, and this is what, just read the Bible. Just get into the Bible and read the stories. They're so appropriate to our life and to our situation. The more things change, the more they stay the same. David does something very peculiar. David pretends to be insane. David starts acting all ticky and crazy and foaming at the mouth in order to get away from the Philistines. That's an actual thing that actually happened. And so that whole thing where, you know, and we've taught that to our kids, right? You know, if you can't fight very good, just pretend to be a little weird and a little off and people will leave you alone. That's from the Bible. That started in the Bible. And so that's what David did. He's in the Philistine camp and he just starts foaming and twitching and gets out of there. And he flees to a cave. But unfortunately, that's not the entirety of the story. You see, when David had his interaction with Ahimelech, someone else heard it. It was a man by the name of Doeg who was the chief herdsman for King Saul. And as usual, when people eavesdrop, Doeg didn't hear the whole conversation. He heard enough of it just to be dangerous. And Doeg went back to Saul and said, I've got bad news. David is conspiring against you. Not only is David conspiring against you, but he's conspiring against you with the chief priest. Doeg tells Saul like this in 1 Samuel 22, verse 10. He says, and he inquired of the Lord for him, talking about Ahimelech, and gave him provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Your enemy, Saul, this chief priest just prayed for him, fed him, armed him, and sent him on his way. Then the king sent to summon Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, the priests who were at Nob, and all of them came to the king. And Saul said to him, why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, in that you have given him bread and a sword, and inquired of God of him? It's like, you're in this with David, and my son Jonathan has turned against me, and my daughter, his wife, has turned against me, and now the priest has turned against me too. Saul is wild with paranoia and suspicion. It continues, so that he has risen against me to lie in wait as at this day. Then Ahimelech answered the king, and who among all your servants is so faithful as David? Who is the king's son-in-law and captain over your bodyguard and honored in your house? Ahimelech's trying to talk Saul down and say, look, who do you trust more than David? He's been your bodyguard. He's your son-in-law. There's no conspiracy here. And verse 15 says, is today the first time that I have inquired of God for him? He's like, I've prayed for David before. I'm a priest. That's what I do. No, let not the king impute anything to his servant or to all the house of my father, for your servant has known nothing of this, much or little. And the king says, you shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all of your father's house. Your father's house means your whole family. And the king said to the guard who stood about him, turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand is also with David, and they knew that he fled and did not disclose it to me. So Saul, wild with paranoia and rage, orders the slaughter of this priest Ahimelech and his entire family. But none of the king's warriors would do it. They're like, look, we'll kill your enemies, we'll kill your friends, but we're not going to kill the priest. That's bad juju, and we don't need that kind of thing in our life. So Saul's warriors wouldn't do it, but someone stepped up to do it. Perhaps he was looking for a promotion. Perhaps he just wanted to find favor with the king. But Doeg, the chief herdsman, said, well, I'll do it. And Doeg slaughtered 85 priests that day. And then the king gave the order to go to the village of Nob and kill every man, every woman, and every child, because he was enraged that he felt like he had been deceived. And so they slaughter the entire village. Very few people escaped, but one of the people who escaped the village was one of Ahimelech's sons, who was able to track down David. And he tracks him down and he tells him what happened, that his father and the priests and this entire village has been wiped out. And David is broken. And in 1 Samuel 22, verse 22, David says, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of your father's house. It was my fault. David was responsible for the death of an entire village because of his anger, his isolation, and his fear, because he chose to lie, because he chose to take matters into his own hands. See, taking matters into our own hands oftentimes feels right, but it usually never results very good. It doesn't turn out very good. And some of you may feel like just because of the plot you are in life right now, that this is like I'm preaching like to you, like how did you know? Were you a fly on the wall of my house this week? But this is just a reality for all of us. This is common sense. And so it leaves us, based on this story and what we understand, it leaves us with questions that we have to ask of ourselves based on our killer giants in our life. What are you considering that you shouldn't be considering? Because you're angry, because you're afraid, because you feel isolated. Maybe it's relationally, financially, physically, spiritually. What are you considering that you know you shouldn't be considering? And have you ever seen that work out for anybody? You know, we can look and, like I said, we can see the end result in other people's lives. You know, don't go down that path because we see where it ends for you. Well, what are you considering that you know you shouldn't be considering? Perhaps who? Who are you considering that you know you shouldn't be considering? Relationships that we oftentimes pursue, or jobs or opportunities, and we're simply pursuing them because we're angry, or we're fearful, or we're lonely. How many of us in our single life kind of, you know, we would dial up somebody not because we saw a future or we liked them, we're just kind of lonely and just wanted to be. It wasn't just me, you're all liars, okay? you pursued things because you were lonely, or you just felt isolated. And you perhaps pursued being around people or being with people that you really had no business being around. A better question sometimes is, who aren't you considering that you should be considering, but you're not because you're angry, afraid, or isolated? It might be a people group that you are avoiding or ignoring. It might be a hand of forgiveness that needs stretched out. But because of your fear, because of your anger, because of your loneliness, you refuse to consider those people or that situation. And whose future? Whose future hangs in the balance of the decisions that you make, fueled out of your anger, your fear, or your loneliness? Whose future hangs in the balance of your ability to either conquer or cave to these killer giants? For David, it was an entire village. For you, it will be something else. And what advice would you give you if you were you? What advice would you give you if you were to look at you from afar? We know the advice that David would give us. It's recorded in things like Psalm 9. As we spoke about with David, we get not only the history and the detailed story of his life, but we also get this unique perspective. We get his inner monologue. We get kind of his thoughts along the way as he wrote poems and songs. And if David were to look at you, he would give you this advice. Psalm 9:9 says, the Lord is a stronghold for the oppressed, a stronghold in times of trouble. And this word gets used a lot, and we don't use it a lot anymore, but a stronghold was simply a safe place during war. When everything around you was crazy and violent and dangerous and scary, a stronghold was a place that you could go and be safe. And David says, the Lord is your stronghold. Not that relationship you shouldn't be pursuing, not that opportunity you need to stay away from, not that chemical that you're addicted to, but the Lord is your stronghold. And he says in verse 10, "And those who know your name put their trust in you, for you, O Lord, have not forsaken those who seek you." David would tell you, those giants in my life, the anger, the fear, the isolation, they made me feel forsaken, but I should have remained rooted in my stronghold, the Jehovah God. And the great thing is, 1,000 years after this story happened, 1,000 years after this story took place, David's most famous descendant would look into the eyes of very frightened, very scared, very abandoned, very overtaxed Israelites. And 1,000 years after this story, Jesus would say to them in Matthew chapter 11, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." Jesus says, "I'm the stronghold now. I'm the one you turn to when you are angry. I'm the one you turn to when you are isolated. I'm the one you turn to when you are fearful. Come to me and you will experience rest." He goes on to say in verse 29, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." Say, when you feel forsaken, you are mistaken. God is with you. And when Ahimelech brought out that sword, I should have turned around and I should have ran away. But make no mistake about it, a yoke, if you look at the definition of what a yoke is, that's a word that we don't use a lot. A yoke is something, a bar by which two draft animals, we normally talk about oxen, are joined together at the heads or necks for working together. Or a yoke is a frame fitted to a person's shoulders to carry a load in two equal portions. Make no mistake about it, a yoke is a burden. A yoke is designed to lead, guide, direct, and oftentimes even control you. But just as Jesus said, we talked last week, Jesus said, you know, you will experience tribulation. It's guaranteed, but take heart, I've overcome the world. In this passage, Jesus is saying, you're going to wear a yoke. I promise there will be something that will lead, guide, direct, and oftentimes control you. So if you're going to wear a yoke, wear my yoke. Where am I? Let me lead you. Let me guide you. Let me direct you, because we will do it together. I will bear this with you. Take my yoke upon you. Take my worldview upon you. Take my perspective on you, because this yoke is light and this burden is easy. And it will be contrary to the yoke of the world. It will be contrary to the things that want to lead and guide and direct you based on your fear, based on your anger, based on your loneliness. But take my yoke, because that's how you will experience rest. You will still have burdens. You will still wear a yoke. But you will never be alone.